Hi, this is Rob Cohen. This is Book Therapy Episode 1. I created this podcast for two reasons. One, last year, 2012, I made a concerted effort to try and read more of the classics of literature that had typically been assigned to junior high school and high school students, books that somehow or other I managed to avoid and not read while I was growing up. I've always loved to read, but somehow the idea of having to read a classic was just not appealing to me, and so I avoided it. But I figured that in the next decade or so, my daughters would probably be reading some of these books as part of their own education, and that if I read them, I could at least discuss it with them, help them with their schoolwork, maybe give them different perspectives on the things they were reading, and all in all, be a little bit more participatory in their educational process. The second reason that I wanted to create this podcast is because after I finish reading a book, usually I want to speak about it, I want to talk about it. And reading a book is not the same as watching a TV show or watching a movie. There's no real interaction with any of the other participants. At the end of a movie, you can walk out, talk to the person you're with, say, hey, what was your favorite part? But when you're reading a book, it's such a solitary endeavor that, at least in my instance, when I'm done, I want to talk about it. And I don't usually have anybody to talk about it with. I'm not a member of any book groups. The idea is, or at least my perspective is, that the book groups are typically women. They read chick lit and deeply sensitive stuff, and that's really not the types of books that I'm into. But I do want to talk about the books when I'm done reading them, and I figured, hey, this is as good a place as any for me to vent. A perfect example of a book that falls into that second category is a book that I just finished called The 24th Letter by Tom Lowe. Now, this was a book I picked up on my Kindle for $1.99. Seemed like an interesting idea. Kind of the description of the book gave it a little bit of a feeling like a Da Vinci Code, Angels and Demons, something along those lines. Now, I haven't read either of Dan or any of Dan Brown's books, and I don't really have much of an interest in it, but for some reason, this book, the idea of it seemed to appeal to me. The story, or at least the general story, is that a former homicide detective named Sean O'Brien, who retired from the Miami police force 11 years ago, had put away a killer, a guy who had killed his supermodel girlfriend by the name of Alexandria. And after 11 years, the appeals have worn out, and the killer, the convicted killer, is now on death row and is scheduled to be executed within the next 4 or 5 days. In the 11 years since the main character, Sean O'Brien, has retired from the force, he hasn't really given this crime any more attention or any more thought than any other ones. He was known as a great detective, but nothing about this case stood out to him. Until a witness comes forward, a witness who claims to have been present when the murder took place, knows where the murder weapon is found, knows where the murder weapon is located, and as part of his coming to God type of a moment, he wants to rat out who the real culprit is. So he finds a priest, a Father Callahan, and he offers to make the confession to Father Callahan. And the father recommends that this witness, Mr. Spelling, basically write down his confession, put it in writing, give as much information as he wishes, and before anything can be done with this information, however, Spelling is killed. But he did deliver this written letter to Father Callahan, who, it just so happens, Father Callahan is very good friends with none other than Sean O'Brien, the main character, of course. So Father Callahan calls Sean O'Brien and says, hey, you remember that crime, the one with the dead supermodel, you put away the boyfriend? Well, it turns out that we have a witness here, and he claims that somebody else did the shooting. Actually, I take the back, it was a stabbing, but somebody else was the culprit of the crime. And Father Callahan tells Sean that he has a written confession from this witness identifying the true killer of the supermodel. But as is enough to create drama, before Sean can get to the father and pick up that letter, the father is killed and the letter goes missing. But the father was a fairly smart individual, And while he was lying on the floor of the church, gunshot wounds, blood spilling out, he manages in his last few minutes of life to sketch some artwork on the floor using his own blood. A picture, some letters, some numbers. For whatever reason, they don't make sense to anybody, of course, but Sean seems to think that Father Callahan was giving him a message. And so Sean, now knowing that the person he put away may be innocent, believes that he has to decipher what the code is from this father and determine who the real culprit is, all within the next few days before the killer on death row is put to death. Now, this seems like a pretty cool story. I mean, we've all been in a situation where we feel like maybe we made the wrong decision. We would love to rectify a past wrong. And in this situation, Sean's got that opportunity. And moreover, you've got the added twist of this weird cipher that Father Callahan has drawn in his own blood on the floor of the church. And it gives a little bit of a, like I said, a Dan Brown type of a feeling to it. Oh, but would that have been the case? Because somewhere along the way, And that gives an explanation later as to why. But the main character goes off on this weird tangent, which has him going through drug dealers and potential Aryan Brotherhood type hate crime people. And he gets wrapped up in some underground fighting ring where it's like cockfighting but with humans. And it's all just a huge MacGuffin, basically. It drives nowhere. It just serves to delay Sean's determination of who the person is, and it really takes the reader on a ride which is unimportant. And all the while, Sean knows that Father Callahan was trying to leave him a message. Sean knows that Father Callahan knew Sean was coming and figured that if he gave some sort of a note, drew something, gave some clue, that Sean would be able to figure it out. But Sean is off running around Miami, going to strip clubs and going to nightclubs and picking up a stripper and harassing everybody, and by the way, being sought after by the cops, that he loses sight of the fact that the father left him the instructions, left him some clues, and he just, I guess for whatever reason, stops thinking about it. And so after 300 pages of this, finally it dawns on Sean that he needs to figure out what that cipher was, and somehow or other he ends up determining that a friend of his is an expert in Greek numerology, having to do with the Greek alphabet having numeric qualities, and also happens to be an expert on art history, and determines that the drawing that this father did in his own blood is a reference to a Hieronymus Bosch painting. And that the guy is able to figure that out. Sean, by the way, is able to figure out that he recognizes the symbol by looking up at the moon one night, and the moon had a quality that made it look sort of like what the father had drawn in his own blood. And that made him think that it was some sort of piece of art that he had seen when he was a kid. So that's only the beginning of how it got to be so far-fetched. Because what you end up finding is that Father Callahan had received the handwritten letter from the witness, and he had it all along. It was in the church. But no one bothered to look for it. And at one point, when Sean's there at the church after Father Callahan had been killed, and Father Callahan, you know, laying on the ground before the coroner had even come to take over, Sean realized that it was in the church. He says that he believed that based on where Father Callahan was resting, that Father Callahan was crawling in a certain direction. And he looks in the direction and says, well, it's clear that Father Callahan was trying to crawl towards the altar. So Sean goes up to the altar and he looks around and he leaves through a few pages of the large Bible that lays open right there on the altar. And of course, Sean doesn't find anything. He finds it in the exact same book 300 pages later. He was looking at the book. I mean, he knew that the father was going in that direction. He looked around, and yet for the kind of cop he was, with he shows you later on how perceptive he is, because he's able to, you know, figure out what direction a shot came from, and he's able to decipher that there's pieces of a snow cap on a decedent's rink, on a dead person's rink, but he doesn't look close enough at the altar itself to find the letter that's right there and ended up being there the whole time. So that's just one of the problems, one of the things. But let's go back, because there's something else. There's another piece of this that really strains the bounds of believability. So it turns out that the bad guy in the book ends up being somebody you've seen throughout the book, of course, and somebody who has some sort of a specific tie to the Greek culture. And somehow, when Father Callahan is shot by this person, the father was able to decipher, or knew, or for doesn't even explain how, but he determined that the culprit was related to the Greek culture. In fact, he was able to figure out where the culprit was born. Now, it doesn't say what information Father Callahan had to lead him to believe this, but he somehow was able to determine where the culprit was born. And the story gives you a little bit more information on Father Callahan, that apparently he's an art expert, of course, and by being an art expert, he knew that he could draw a symbol out of his own blood that would represent a specific painting that the main character, Sean O'Brien, would be able to decipher, and would know that it was leading him directly back to the very altar on which that Bible was found. So here's what we're supposed to believe. We're supposed to believe that after Father Callahan was shot, that he was able to decipher, he knew the culprit, or somehow was able to find out who the culprit was, the person's identity, at least his last name, because his last name figures into this whole theory of Greek numerology and the values of the individual Greek letters. But, so Father Callahan is shot twice. And in the book it says he's dying and he knows it. He's probably going into shock. He doesn't have much time. He maybe has a minute or two. And his mind was losing oxygen. Okay. Well, then I guess it does make sense that with all of that being said, he was able to, out of his own blood, think to some obscure painting from the 1500s, be able to focus on one small section of that painting, be able to focus on it enough to draw a reasonable and plausible likeness of that small section of the painting with his own blood, with his own finger, that he was also able to consider the identity of the killer, the fact that the killer's name had Greek numerological qualities, was able to calculate what the numerological quality was down to a specific number, which of course was 666, and then was even able to get halfway through the spelling of the place that the killer had come from. All of this while he had been shot twice, he's dying and he knows it, he's probably going into shock, he doesn't have much time, maybe a minute or two left, and his mind was losing oxygen. All of this, this father was still able to direct Sean O'Brien using this weird, complex cipher that nobody could figure out. I mean, it's completely unbelievable. This isn't like, you know, looking at the pictures and finding the subtext in the background and all that stuff that was Da Vinci Code or whatever it was. And that's what I thought this book was going to be. Not that, you know, that stuff typically interests me, but for some reason I like the idea of a character who had thought that he had done the right thing, and now 11 years later finds out that maybe he had put the wrong guy away, and it's his mission to try and save this guy before he gets to death, you know, he gets put to death. I like that aspect of it, and I certainly like the tension that's caused by the time ticking away as we get closer and closer to the execution day. But still, this was completely misleading, because there's no way anybody could not only have created that cipher while, you know, bleeding out on the floor, but there's no way that anybody could have decided, could have deciphered it. Instead, it just so happens that Sean has a friend who shares the same berth as he does, where they park their boats. This friend, who was some sort of an art historian or expert on Greek numerology or whatever it was, that this guy was able to figure it all out. And in fact, in some place in his books, the character says, you know, if I remember my Greek numerology correctly, it's like, what? Who, you remember your Greek? Nobody knows this stuff. And nobody would know it off the top of their head. But the fact that it was an important enough tool for Father Callahan to use to direct Sean to where the letter was, just so happened that one of Sean's best friends was similarly an expert. I mean, they must go around trees, right? I mean, everybody here is an expert on Greek numerology. I mean, when you think about it, you look at these TV shows like CSI or even some of the other police procedurals that I've read, and Michael Connelly has been my favorite author of the police procedurals. They do such a detailed inventory of everything that's at the crime scene. And you've seen on TV when, you know, a Law and Order, the cops are coming to deliver a search warrant. They go through everything. They go through the drawers. They go through the shelves. They go through the pages of the books. And you mean to tell me that this crime scene where Father Callahan was shot and where Sean says he knows that the letter is there or was there, you mean to tell me that nobody did a far enough search to look through the books that were on the table? When Sean says he was going to the altar and it just happens the Bible's there. I mean, Sean says, we need to find the letter. Maybe Father Callahan hid it before the killer walked in. Okay. Well, if he did hide it, it's not going to be in plain sight, Sean, while you're standing there at the altar just looking around. You know, maybe you do need to open a book or two, or maybe you need to open a drawer or two, or maybe you need to look under some stack of papers. I mean, come on, he's not going to hide it in plain sight. Now, I will say this about the book. When the killer is identified, Sean figures out that it's the killer who had directed him onto this wild goose chase in the first place. The idea of drugs and the involvement of some nightclub owner and all that stuff about heroin and a previous drug conviction, all that kind of stuff. So the bad guy, the killer, did direct Sean on that wild goose chase in order to hopefully keep Sean busy enough that the execution could take place before the killer's identity was discovered. But everything about the book and everything about Sean O'Brien leads you to believe that he's, you know, the loose cannon. He's the guy who goes off the reservation. He doesn't have any respect for rules, and his focus is to get the job done and make sure he gets the right guy. And he's not going to let, you know, things such as, you know, the rules of making, you know, identifying yourself as a police officer or not threatening a potential witness with bodily harm if he doesn't admit that he knows who did it. I mean, that's not who Sean is. So the fact that he was so easily led astray by the killer himself, it's really kind of antithetical to who the character really was. And so what it seemed like to me was that the author was trying to create a little bit of a Dan Brown type of a feel to it. But at the end of the day, it was just a regular mystery that could have been solved, really relatively easily could have been solved, without any of this other cipher BS. Because at one point, they go to one of the scenes of a murder, because numerous people are killed by the killer while this is all going on. Sean goes to the scene of one of them and is able to figure out exactly where the killer took his shot from, and was even able to find a shell casing from the gun that was used to kill this particular witness. But Sean never does anything with the casing. He never says, we need to get this to someplace. We never need to get it to the lab to have it, inspected and analyzed for epithelials or whatever it is, fingerprints. I mean, anything like that. I mean, it was from a specific type of a gun. It was a specific caliber. It was obviously from some sort of a marksman who had some great sniper capabilities. But that aspect of the case, that potential lead, so to speak, was never really followed up on. And you think about it, if Sean had If he had simply followed the evidence, he might have gotten there anyways. And on top of that, let's not forget one other thing. There were multiple murders that had taken place all within that couple day period. And it seemed like the rest of the police, they weren't doing anything. They weren't investigating anything. They went to the scene of some of the crimes, but they looked around and went, well, it looks like there's no evidence here. And then they pretty much just backed off. It's like they never showed up again. When Sean found the shell casing, it was on the third floor of a 19-story parking structure or something like that. And when they go there, Sean says, well, you know, didn't anybody look in that parking structure? And the guy he's with says, well, yeah, well, they looked on the first floor and the 19th floor. It's like, okay, well, did you find anything on the roof? No. Okay. Well, of course, Sean, being the skilled Sherlock Holmesian type of investigator he is, he says, oh, well, it's clear that the guy shot from the third or fourth floor. Let's go to the third floor. And, as you would expect, on the third floor, there's a shell casing. Well, you mean to tell me that if the cops knew from which direction the shot came from, and were able to determine it came from a parking structure, even if it's 19, 25, 100 stories tall, that they aren't going to do enough investigation to look at the whole entire parking structure? Well, it's not on the 19th floor, and he didn't shoot from the first floor, so, you know what, I guess we gotta pack it in, we can't find it. Really? I mean, come on. I mean, it was so nonsensical. But other than that, Mrs. Lincoln, how was the play? Well, hey, the book was fine. I mean, I didn't hate it. I found some issues with it, some things that I felt were just really stretched the bounds of believability. And in a lot of these police procedurals, they are believable. That's kind of what is enticing about them to me. They're not fantasy. They're not created by out of thin air. They are founded in some sort of a believable subject, believable characters, believable evidence, and this one just didn't do it for me. The character was created, or at least the information is given that he's got some depth to him. He had a successful career. His wife died from cancer. He quit the force, and I'm not sure what he's been doing since then, but he's obviously been distanced from his friends. He was distanced from the priest, from Father Callahan. So he's obviously got some sort of a backstory that would be compelling. But then he just runs around like a chicken with his head cut off, just kind of guessing along at this, or maybe it's that, and maybe it's this. And he's, you know, at one point he thinks he knows who the killer is, so he gets a stone crab, and he gets the people who caught the stone crab to cut the rubber bands off, and he holds the stone crab up to the potential bad guy's hand. He says, if you tell me that you killed her, or else I'm gonna, you know, use the stone crab to cut off your finger. It's like, really? I mean, this is not the intrepid investigator that we've been led to believe existed, who was such an all-star on the force and who retired 11 years earlier to after, you know, an impeccable record, or at least a record of incredible success, that he's a legend amongst the force. I mean, is that really even the same guy? So anyways, it's just not, I was disappointed, obviously. I felt that I was misled, not only by the subject of the book, but by the characters themselves. I felt like they didn't act realistically, and I'm a big proponent of books, mysteries, where the audience has an opportunity to participate, where the audience sees all of the evidence at the same time the main character sees it, and the mystery unravels as the reader is proceeding through the book. And in this one, there was no way in H.E. Double Hockey Sticks that anybody would have been able to figure out, from this weird drawing that the priest did out of his own blood after he'd been shot twice, was losing oxygen, had only a minute or two to live, and was going into shock. There's no way anybody could have figured that out. And there's no way that the reader could have figured it out. And that's the part that I think is most distressing. There's no way the reader could have figured it out. And so instead of being an active participant in the story, the reader is simply an outsider who's watching. And to me, that makes for less than compelling reading. More to the point, I feel like I just want to read it to get it over with, find out who did it, and move on to something else, because it's not enveloping me in the story. I am not subsumed by it. I am watching a game. I am watching a TV show. I am just watching it and looking at my watch and counting down to see when it's going to end so that I can then go on to something else. And that's really the main reason why I was just not as enthralled by this book as I'd hoped to be, as certainly as I'd hoped to be based on what the book jacket had described it as. Now, to move on to a book that figures as part of the first reason why I created this podcast, I recently read Brave New World by Aldous Huxley, written in 1932. I didn't know anything about Brave New World. My understanding of Brave New World was that it was a similar type of a view into the future as 1984 by George Orwell, that it was some sort of a vision of a utopia, although I didn't know quite what that meant. And other than that, I felt that it was probably something that was pretty dry and boring, because what the hell could somebody in 1932 know about the future, and how could he, you know, be creative enough to come up with something? And other than that, the only thing else I knew about it was that my brother had read it when he was in high school. Somehow or other, I managed to avoid it. I don't remember if he remembered anything about the book. I don't even remember if he liked the book. Odds are he probably didn't, although later he told me that he did. But I didn't know anything about the book. So I read it over the course of a couple days, and it was absolutely stunning. The first thing I thought was interesting was that one of the main characters, her name is Lenina Crown, L-E-N-I-N-A, is her first name. And I'm a big movie guy. And when I thought about Lenina, it's just such an odd name. And yet, one of the characters from the movie Demolition Man, it was obviously apparent to me, was named Lenina. That was the character played by Sandra Bullock. And in that movie especially, which is, I really like the movie. I've seen it many, many times. Sandra Bullock, I think, looks fantastic and hasn't looked that good since. But her character's name was Lenina Huxley. And as I'm reading the book, Brave New World, and I come to the character of Lenina, it just clicks. It's like, Lenina Huxley. Lenina Crown from the book Brave New World, Lenina, and the last name Huxley, Aldous Huxley. So immediately, I have a feeling that there's a sort of connection to the book, because I've figured out that the character name and the author name were used as a basis for a character in the movie Demolition Man, which by itself was a view in the future of a utopia where there's no crime, where it seems to be that everybody is happy, where the police officers do very little actual police work, and there's certainly no touching or contact as far as dealing with criminals, because they don't know what to do with criminals. So almost immediately I was kind of brought into the book from that standpoint. Like, I felt like I was part of an inside joke, so to speak. Now, the book itself is not particularly expansive as far as its scope of a story. There's really not much of a story. The basics of it is it's a future world. It's a future vision of our world in which everybody is, for the most part, happy, but they're happy because they're genetically created to be specific cogs in the world machine, so to speak. So there are factories which are in existence to genetically engineer all different levels of people. The people who are the high elite intelligence-wise, all the way down to the people who are basically the worker bees, the not particularly intelligent, but also not ignorant to the point of not being happy with who they are. The genetic engineering process has created a society of people who are happy with their station, regardless of what it is. And at one point in the book, one of the characters says, the people who are the lowest on the rung, they are happy being the lowest on the rung because they don't know anything different. It's a society where there's free sex, and in fact, the sex is so free as to be encouraged, because nobody can get pregnant because of the genetic engineering, and the women are taught how to take care of themselves to ensure that they don't get pregnant. And it just seems like a world that is, for lack of a better word, perfect. I mean, everybody's got their place, and everybody travels by helicopter, and everybody can have sex with whoever they want, and there's no care or concern for hurting somebody's feelings. It doesn't seem like anybody really has any feelings other than, hey, isn't life great? But the true commentary of the book takes place when Lenina and another main character, Bernard, take a trip to, I think it's New Mexico. They live in London, but they take a trip to New Mexico, and they get to visit what, from my own vision of it, looks to be like some sort of a wildlife preserve. But instead of wildlife, like we would consider it in Africa, safari and animals, things like that, it's actually a section of society that has not been integrated into the utopia of that day. And in fact, it's a society of people who continue to live the way they lived back in, you know, the early ages, meaning, you know, the 1930s, so to speak. And so Bernard and Lenina go to visit this preserve and see how the people live, kind of like a zoo safari type of a thing. And while they're there, they find out that there's an actual son of one of the utopian head honchos, that a guy who was high up in the utopian society had gotten a woman pregnant, dropped her off in New Mexico, said goodbye, you know, I'm paraphrasing, of course, and then she had this baby there. And Bernard thinks it would be great to reunite the son, who's now more than a teenager, I seem to think, to reunite the son with his biological father. Well, as you can imagine, it all goes to pot, because the son is now critical of the utopian society, because he, while he was growing up on this preserve, had access to all the great pieces of literature, specifically the Bible and Shakespeare, and the utopian society has none of that anymore. There's no more literature. There's no more books. There's no more history. They've decided that that stuff is pretty much irrelevant, that the people in the utopian society don't need to know that stuff, because why would they care? It's not going to add to their happiness. And yet the son, who they call the savage, which I think is kind of interesting, he starts to, well, at first he's like a showpiece. Everybody wants to see him. Everybody wants to meet him. And Bernard is the toast of the town because he has the savage with him in his house. And he's the one who brought the savage back. And he's just the celebrated high dude in the utopian society in London. But the savage finally gets a little bit wise, and he realizes that Bernard is using him, and he decides he's not going to participate anymore. He's not going to play. He's not going to be the trophy. He's not going to be the caged animal where people are going to come and look at him anymore. He's actually going to try and challenge the society. Now, I won't spoil the ending for you, although it was a little bit predictable how it was going to end. But the thing that I found so interesting about the book was a couple things. First, the creativity that went into creating the utopian society was just astounding. The opening 20 or so pages is basically a tour of the factory at which the genetic engineering is taking place, and it's told from the standpoint of a tour guide instructing or giving orientation to the brand new employees at the factory itself. And it's just amazing how much detail and how much creativity went into illustrating the factory itself, illustrating each of the levels and what each of the different cogs in the machine were responsible for producing for the utopian society. And it was just, I had to give a little bit of thought just to the idea that somebody came up with this, that somebody was creative enough to keep up with this. Because like I mentioned, I'm not big into fantasy. I'm not big into science fiction. So the idea that people have the capability of creating things which are otherworldly or don't exist or are fantastical is just a level of creativity that I don't myself have. And the other thing that I found so intriguing about the book was that the character of the savage, I couldn't help but picture him as a kind of Tarzan. Tarzan, as we all know, was raised by apes, and had lived a savage lifestyle, raised by these apes, until he is taken out of his jungle and brought back into London society. Now, I'm not sure if that's really the actual story of Tarzan, or if that's the Tarzan that I remember from that crappy movie in the early 80s, or even if that's the way that it was in the Disney movie of a decade ago. But the way I picture it is, in Brave New World, the savage is a Tarzan. He's being raised by, for lack of a better word, apes, people who don't conform with society, people who beat each other and have wild sex with each other and rape, and they are all, for intents and purposes, savages compared with this utopian society. And then the savage character is taken out of that environment and placed into the utopia, the perfect world. And obviously there's an impossible adjustment that he has to make. He can't make, and in the end the result is unfortunately disastrous. Now, I don't know if I'm the only one who gave that any thought. I haven't read any treatises on Brave New World or literary analysis or anything of that nature, but that was the feeling that I got, that it was kind of like this Tarzan character. But the thing about the book that really stuck with me was the fact that I pretty much was smiling throughout the entire book. And when I say smiling, I actually had a big grin on my face, because I use that as a basis for how enjoyable the book is whether it makes me smile, if whether my eyes light up, whether I'm reading the book with such a verve and intensity because it's so awesome to me. Because it is not only intriguing, but it is intoxicating. And last year, as I was trying to catch up on some of these classics, the book that really stood out for me as having induced that type of reaction was Animal Farm by George Orwell. Interesting that it's an Orwell book because of the relation of Brave New World to the other Orwell book, 1984. But Animal Farm, which is only 100 and something pages, I pretty much read it in one evening, and I smiled throughout the whole thing. I mean, I understood the political machinations of the book. I understood that it was criticizing our political system, but it was so enjoyable and so astounding as to put a smile on my face. And for Brave New World, I had the exact same reaction. Of course, the next day when I mentioned to my brother that I'd read it, his response was, "Oh, wasn't it terrific? Didn't you enjoy it?" And yeah, I really, really did. This is a kind of book where, yeah, I know that it's been banned, and I know that there's criticisms about it because of its free sexual content and the idea that monogamy is unimportant, or even that traditional marital values are non-existent. But it was so enveloping from the standpoint of its originality, its creativity, its passion for this utopian society. And I couldn't help at various times during the book thinking, hey, this utopian society ain't half bad. You know, when we look around and we've got our own issues going on and we've got our own problems and the world is bleak and we hear about nasty things on the news and people who are killing other people and all this kind of violence, you kind of think that a utopian society like in Brave New World, where everybody's happy, everybody has their place in life, relationships aren't complicated, they're easy, that maybe that's not so bad. And I know that Aldous Huxley was attempting to use this book as a criticism of the 1930s and the way that he envisioned society was going to develop over the next 100 years or so. I kind of also want to think that maybe Aldous Huxley was creating a society in which he would like to live. Because isn't that what writers do? And writers have the ability to create worlds, but I like to believe that writers will create societies, create characters, create drama to act out their own fantasies. A character like a Jack Reacher, created by Lee Child. I think that Lee Child, just like the people who read those books, would love to be able to take on, you know, a gang of thugs and beat them all up, and would love to be able to suss out the mystery and save the damsel in distress. We would all love to be that superhero. And I think that writers can get a lot of pleasure out of writing by creating characters and creating situations, creating worlds that they believe they would enjoy living in or being. Look, if I were writing a book, I'd love to create a character who was a Navy SEAL, could do, you know, 1,000 push-ups, you know, in 10 minutes, was able to, you know, read Latin, and could ride a motorcycle, was a great sharpshooter. I mean, these are all things that I myself don't have as characteristics, but the opportunity to live out those fantasies in a character of my creation is enticing. And I know that Brave New World was supposed to be critical, but is it possible that with the way the world was in 1932, so let's think of 1932, the way the world was. World War I was over a little bit more than a decade before. They were in the midst of a Great Depression. The flares of further war were starting to grow in Europe, because don't forget, I think it was Hitler took power in 1933, and there was this general feeling, I think, of instability, that the world was on the precipice, a precipice which would come to fruition basically 9 years later with the attack on Pearl Harbor. So given that situation, isn't it possible that instead of being critical, or maybe intending to be critical, but a small portion of the intention in writing the book was for Huxley to create a society in which none of those problems existed, that things would be great, things would be calm, things would be happy? I mean, isn't it possible? Anyways, that's it for this first episode of Book Therapy. And thank you for letting me lie down on the couch. And thanks for listening to me vent. Talk to you next time.